Hello and welcome to That's a Thing, a sometimes belated, already outdated guide to your teens, tweens, and everything under 20. I'm Elizabeth.
And I'm Karen, and we're a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network powered by ATB. We're doing something different this month because Elizabeth just finished surviving exams.
Yes, I never have to do math again.
Don't be math phobic. It's good for you. It's good for you. Do math.
I'm never doing math again, Mom. No. I will evade taxes. I will live in the woods. I'm not doing math anymore. I finished all of my math courses. I finished physics, which God knows why I took that. And now I never have to do math again. And that's the law. And so there you go.
It's so disempowering. But we'll talk about this another time because we're not here to talk about that, are we?
No.
No, we're here because we still wanted to do an episode. And as it happened, the vaults contained something that we could use for this episode. So a few months back, we had a chance to appear on Putting It Together, which is Kyle Marshall's podcast exploring Stephen Sondheim's body of work, show by show and song by song. And he invited us on to talk about a song.
Yes, he did do that thing.
Do you remember which one it was?
I'm bad at this.
It was a long time ago. In the fall. We talked about With So Little to Be Sure Of, which is the final song in Anyone Can Whistle.
Yes.
And it was maybe not your favorite show.
Or my favorite song in that show, yep.
Yeah. But we always find things to talk about, and I, of course, as is my wont, came around to both the show and the song over by listening to his season and the show.
You push over.
Yes, I'm very malleable that way, but regardless, we still love talking to Kyle about Sondheim, right?
Yes, we do. Mm-hmm. And if you want to hear me complain about stuff and Mum be persuaded by stuff, then you're about to listen to that, so you're welcome.
This is also a little bit of a segue to our next episode, right?
Yes, it is.
How so?
Okay, so we're going to be doing something a little bit different. If you know me, then you know that I'm kind of into musical theater a little bit, and I do it through Ross Shepherd High School, which is the high school I go to. If you want to stalk me, you're welcome.
No, don't stalk it.
But do pay to go see the show that I'm doing.
That's true.
So we're doing kind of a half marketing, half I'm just interested in this thing sort of experiment. So we're going to be talking about musical theater, specifically contemporary musical theater, mainstream musical theater. We're going to talk about the people my age who are super into it, how that's affected us, and also how we have affected the industry. It's going to be interesting. It's going to be different, and I'm looking forward to it. So hopefully you guys will like that too.
Yeah, I think it's going to be fun. And also we might rope Kyle into this again, hey?
Yes. We will kidnap him. And make him talk about contemporary musical theater.
I don't think he'd be opposed. I think he'd be fine. I think he'd be willing. He's got pre-Stockholm syndrome. Speaking of Kyle and Putting It Together, he is also up for a couple of Canadian Podcast Awards in the arts and music categories. And guess what, Elizabeth?
What?
That's a Thing is also nominated for a Canadian Podcast Award.
Gasp.
Anyway, if you are a Canadian podcaster and you are listening to this episode before February 18th, 2020, you could even vote for us if you wanted to. You will find us and Putting It Together and a whole bunch of other Alberta Podcast Network shows at awards.podcamptoronto.com. If you're not a podcaster, you could vote in the People's Choice Awards, in which our friends Modern Manhood and Emily Misdout are nominated. So we'll link to all of that in the show notes.
Woo.
Yeah. Before we head into the show, we want to let you know that this episode of That's a Thing is brought to you by Skirts of Fire, which is Edmonton's only multidisciplinary arts festival featuring and elevating the work of women.
Exciting.
This year's festival is bigger than ever before, with venues in Old Strathcona, downtown Edmonton, and Alberta Avenue from February 27th to March 8th. The main stage play this year is The Blue Hour, a timely, funny, complicated, and ultimately heartbreaking play set in a small Alberta town around 1947.
See local theater.
Yeah. if you go on March 1st, then stick around after the matinee and attend a live recording of I Don't Get It, which is a fellow member of the Alberta Podcast Network, too. Lots of log rolling in this episode. Host Fonda Mithrush will moderate a discussion of the issues raised by the play. We had a great job putting on, we had a great time putting on a live show at last year's Skirts Fire.
Yes.
Yes. And we know this one will be wonderful as well. Festival passes are on sale now for just $38, which gets you into the Blue Hour, one performance at the station on Jasper, and as many by donation events as you like. If you only have time to go see the play, then you can get just get tickets for the Blue Hour. And if you use the offer code PANEL5, that's all spelled out, PANELFIVE, you can get $5 off the regular price. Get your tickets today at skirtsoffire.com. That's skirtsoffire.com. And one more thing. Speaking of I Don't Get It, we were on her show too. We were on I Don't Get It recently talking about the Winter Shakespeare Festival, right?
Yes, we are everywhere and the nepotism is powerful.
Yes, well, I have some pull. Anyway. We're heading into the last weekend for that festival in Edmonton. So if you're listening at the end of January or beginning of February, then go listen to us talk about Julius Caesar and A Midsummer Night's Dream on I Don't Get It, and then get yourself to Holy Trinity to see those shows.
They're good.
They're so good. Okay, let's get to our conversation about Anyone Can Whistle with Kyle Marshall of Putting It Together.
Elizabeth and Karen, thank you so much for joining me here today.
Thanks for having us, Kyle.
Yeah. Karen, I know you've been here a few different times here in the past, but Elizabeth, you're new here to the show, so maybe you could introduce yourself, but also explain the podcast you're a part of.
Okay, so I'm Elizabeth. I'm Karen's daughter. I'm 17 years old, going into grade 12, so I'm like a little baby Sondheim fan, you could say. Mom and I do a podcast called That's a Thing, which talks about teen culture and the differences between our generations and sometimes queer issues and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So
you had some experience with musical theater here this summer, correct?
Yeah, I went to Arts Truck, which is a theater camp where you do like a heavy, heavy play study for a week. We did Les Miserables. Yeah. So
that was in Red Deer?
Red Deer College, yeah.
Did you get taught by someone named Tara by any chance?
I don't think so, but I'm also terrible at names.
Okay. There, a previous guest of mine was teaching there this year, so I was just wondering if your paths crossed somehow.
There's a good chance.
It is possible.
But I didn't find that out until last week. So. Karen, since the last time you were on, any new developments, anything new in your life?
Oh my goodness. No, we're just building the Alberta Podcast Network and so happy to have putting it together on it. And it's fun to do That's a Thing together, and we've got a new episode in the can that we got to get out before we go on holidays.
So. Right. we were chatting a little bit before we started recording here, so I kind of know the answer already, but I'll make you answer it for the people listening at home, which is, what is your experience, if anything, with this show in particular, Anyone Can Whistle?
So mine is, I'm pretty sure that I have heard Bernadette Peters or somebody sing Anyone Can Whistle, but not knowing at all what show it was, probably not even knowing it was from a show at the time that I would have heard it. And but otherwise, I've never seen it, it was new to me.
And I'm pretty new to Sondheim in general, like mostly due to age reasons more than anything. Like, haven't had a lot of time to catch up on the whole discography, so I'd never heard of it before I was asked to do the podcast.
Okay. So, I mean, our discussion here today is going to be discussing, of course, the song Whistle Little to Be Sure Of, which is the very last song of the show. But I do want to have like a broader discussion about the show as a whole. I just want to know, just, you know, here at the very beginning, I know that I sent to you some videos, I guess, to watch of the show. So a couple of performances that I don't know how legally they were recorded, but they were recorded, which is nice. I want to know just general thoughts here first before we jump into the song, what you thought of the show.
Okay. Well, I would say that So the first one that we watched was the 2010 one with Sutton Foster. Mm-hmm. And my initial reaction to that was, I don't like this, and now I know why it wasn't successful. Then I started listening to this season of Putting It Together, and as is often the case for me, when I hear something studied, then I sort of get to fall in love with it a little bit. So I have liked it a lot more having heard you and your extremely intelligent and delightful guests talk about.
If you keep telling them that, it's just going to go right to their heads.
That's good. Come back, all of you. So like your show made me like the show more. And then as a kind of a bookend to that, we watched the 1995 benefit concert with Bernadette Peters and Madeleine Kahn, and the narration with Angela Lansbury. And I think I liked it better than the first one, but probably because of that studying love that came from it, not necessarily because it was a better or any different kind of production.
Yeah, it's a hard show to follow. And I think of that first set of audiences, that 60 or whatever group of people.
Yeah.
Like, if I had to see the show twice and still have the plot explained to me by my mother, like, I get why it wasn't successful on that first run, because you don't even have the cast album to go to before that. And, like, nothing that happens in the show seems to really flow into the next event, and sometimes it's so entertaining that that's forgivable, but it also makes it very difficult to understand on first viewing.
Yeah, like the recurring theme that pops up here, and I think what they've settled on, is that there's these little snatches of brilliance that happen in the show. It's unfortunately buried behind just a lot of stuff that I don't care about, and like a little bit half-formed characters and a plot that doesn't really make sense to me a whole lot, or... to put it another way, a plot that I don't care to follow. I don't really care what's happening here right now, which is too bad because there are some great songs, I think, still in this show. But you wouldn't know that necessarily.
Yeah, and I also think that we can hear some proto versions of later Sondheim that we do love. And even we were watching with Elizabeth's brother, John, who's a big Sweeney Todd and Company fan.
Yeah.
And he was hearing from in both, like echoes of both of those shows in this
100%.
Along the way. Yeah.
Yeah, especially when you get to a song like Simple, even though I'm not a huge fan of that song in this show, I can see what he's doing. Like, he's doing the layering and like the plot and talking and singing and all this other stuff going on at the same time.
And the dissonance and the fact that it's not pretty and it's not supposed to be pretty.
It's not supposed to be pretty, yeah.
And it definitely works way better in Sweeney Todd than it does in this, but you can see him starting to have that idea. And I just find myself having like this gratitude that the failure of this show didn't scare him away from taking chances like that.
Yeah, because I could see like an alternate history of this, which is like, oh, no, I'm just going to play it safe. I'm going to do like Do I Hear a Waltz Next? And that's all I'm going to do. That type of show from here on out.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, definitely there's a lot of learning moments. With the song in particular, I know I've mentioned this in quite a few recordings leading up to this final episode. How do you feel about this as an ending song? Because I personally think this is like the weirdest way to end a show.
Yeah. I kind of hate it, and like this does not come from the quality of the song so much as it comes from the quality of my character. I don't like love stories, and everything has a love story in it, and it bothers me. And so when like you have all this satire going on, and you have all this chorus stuff going on, and then you end on like fulfilling that love story a little bit, I don't like that personally as a viewer.
Yeah, and it just feels like sonically, it feels like a letdown. It's like sort of, it's not rousing. It's not, it's just sort of limp.
Well, it's true. We'll get to this here because Sondheim kind of writes about this in his book, Finishing the Hat, exactly how he feels about this song as being the ender. But it is, it's like, oh, that's it? Like, I could feel as an audience member in 1964 and be like, the lights coming up and be like, wait, what? Like, that's how we're going to end this entire show?
That's how John reacted when we were watching. And he said, hang on, is that the end of the show?
And then at the end with the miracle actually happening as well.
Yeah.
Like, you have all this satire about how people will like go out to anything and they aren't skeptical about it. And then you actually, in the end, say, oh, by the way, the miracle is real. It's like, what is that supposed to do with what you were saying earlier? Like,
yeah, let's dig into that a little bit, because I think that's an interesting point. To me, I don't want to lead this too much, but for me personally, that feels very much like it was all a dream,
yeah,
thing that happens in certain movies and TV shows, which I've always hated.
Yeah.
Which is like, okay, well then what was the point of watching this entire thing? And I feel that there was a circle point that they could have landed with that. It's like, oh, this has been an actual miracle the entire time, which I feel has been undercut by the rest of the show a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm going to throw it back to you.
No, I think so too. I think that is... that real miracle is off topic for the rest of the show. Mm-hmm. And then I also hate that she whistles for him. Like, I don't think we needed the extreme literalness of anyone can whistle.
Mm-hmm.
Like, as a metaphor, it's lovely. As an actual plot point, it's stupid.
When she walked on stage for that scene, I'm like, oh, she's going to whistle now. Like, I knew that was going to happen before it happened. Like, that's not really fun to have during a show when it's like, oh, they're going to do the big cheesy climactic moment. Now I'm dreading it happening because I know it's about to. I know they're going to make the wrong decision here.
Well, especially too, because I think... For me, I think the power behind the song Anyone Can Whistle is just the simple fact that, like, she's yearning for someone else. They say, like, it's so easy to do this, and I can't do this. But then she is able to actually affect change, even though she can't do it. So I feel like it undercuts that message by her whistling at the end. It's like, no. It's actually better if she can't. And she still can't whistle. I don't know. Yeah, I'm totally aligned with the both of you in that case.
It's like, for the whole show, they didn't realize what it was about. And so then they veer off what it's actually about all the time, and or it's about like seven different things at the same time.
Is there any of the satire that does work for you at all?
Not really for me. And I think part of that is just a generational thing. Mm. Like, I don't have a ton of context for the time or like general context in life or existence. but like from what I do understand, I'm like, I kind of understand what you're supposed to be satirizing, but I'm not laughing and not entirely sure which part of this thing you're talking about right now. And it's like, sometimes he's talking about religion, sometimes he's talking about social norms, and like it bounces all over the place. So I have no idea what's being criticized at this moment without that context behind it.
Yeah, these little dollops of things that they throw in there, because there's even stuff about like gender and all that kind of stuff, but I don't think it ever is fully explored to its full extent.
Yeah.
And this goes back to my conversation I had in Simple, which is like, I wish they just picked one or two of these and really delved into them a whole lot instead of being like, here's eight things
yeah.
to discuss. But we're not really going to go into any one of them in any depth.
I like the... I'm interested by this idea that sanity is a construct and that we can't really tell who is mad and who is not. And I think that that's worth exploring, but I also think that there's parts of the show that are so insensitive in the way that it explores that, like even calling the people that are in the institution cookies, like it's so demeaning and
it's a bit too cute.
And they're infantilized and they sing that kind of nursery song and and, you know, like, I think we have a much deeper approach to mental illness now than we did then. And plus just the whole idea of, well, what is insane? Like, the world is screwed up, right? Right.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
But that part, like, some of that part, and some of what Hapgood is talking about when he's talking about kind of his... how he became someone that some people thought should be institutionalized. That's some of that kind of rings true for today to me, I think.
I suppose.
You hate that character.
Yeah, so I don't like Hapgood. I feel like he doesn't really do anything productive in the story other than cause chaos and then exit and then come back when he's needed by Fanes. Like, he exists. He's like a sexy lamp with bad ideas. I'd say that's how I describe his character's function in the show. Like, I don't know. I'm not crazy about it, but again, that comes to me not liking love stories. So
I think you've just come up with my first t-shirt that I'm going to release for this. I'm just a sexy lamp with bad ideas. Like I've been saying in some other episodes here, I feel like there's certain things that this episode that this show brings up that I think are super relevant to today. What I would love to see, and I don't know who would be willing to take this on, is literally someone coming in and retooling this entire thing and cutting huge sections out and like just keeping the stuff that still works. I don't know what it would be. Like, it'd be like anyone can whistle the final cut or something like that. And it's like, keep these songs that are like great and that actually prove the point and like cut all the stuff that we do not need to be in this show out. And I think there could be something that's there. Yeah. And then you'd only have to have one intermission, which is great.
That's true. Can I ask, did you do an episode on the Cora Faye song that got cut?
Yes, I did.
You did? Okay, because we were so happy to see that.
It's so much fun. Yeah. It's like my two favorite songs are the cut songs.
Yeah.
from this show, which is fascinating to do, because at least that at like that point, and sometimes for whatever reason, super critical of There's Only a Woman.
Yeah.
But I think that it's the one in time that it like really feels lively, and they're like this banter back and forth, and I feel like you need it because it's the only time Cora and Faye have a song together.
Yeah.
Where they're singing opposite of one another back and forth. So anyways, it works better for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, we were reading over the lyrics book, mm-hmm. and the annotation he put was, it didn't get the applause we were expecting, so we cut it. And I'm like, but you cut an important plot point that connected your two, like, the two halves of your story together. Yeah. And without it, these could be two separate plays with no attachment. Like, that's the point where they reconcile with each other as these two opposing forces. And without that, each play could exist independent of the other one fairly well. They're never in the same room together.
No, that's
Faye
right.
And Cora.
It's like they meet once at the very beginning briefly. Like they pass each other and it's like then they never talk to each other ever again, which is, it's just an odd way to structure the show. Let's jump into the lyrics here then. So this is, again, we're in the very final song of the show. You know, Hapgood kind of returns back onto the scene and he wants her to come with him. She wants to go back to the cookie jar and kind of return to being the nurse and everything. But Hapgood is trying to now convince her that, no, they should like go away together is basically what his hope is here, at least. So he begins by saying, with so little to be sure of, if there's anything at all, if there's anything at all, I'm sure of here and now and us together. All I'll ever be, I owe you, if there's anything to be. Being sure enough of you makes me sure enough of me.
With so little to be sure of, if there's anything at all, if there's anything at all, I'm sure of here and now, and us together. All I'll ever be, I owe you. If there's anything to be, being sure enough of you makes me sure enough of me.
I think there's two questions that arise from this. A, I just want to know, like, literally what your first initial thoughts are from those lyrics. But there's the sub point, does this actually land for you? If this is like kind of like the ending of the piece and this is what we're supposed to be leaving with, does this actually track with everything that's happened before it?
Well, I think where it doesn't track is who cares what his journey is? He's not even supposed to be like a main character, right? Like he's supposed to be supporting to these two fantastic, or should be fantastic, strong and interesting women.
Mm-hmm.
I'm never going to like a Hapgood song, I think, just based on my principles as a person who like likes certain things and doesn't like other things. But again, I'm like, I don't care what you think. And also this relationship, you guys have broken up like twice already, is it? Like,
yeah,
I don't believe in the stability of your relationship at this point, so I'm not willing to get invested.
Yeah, I think for this to... like here's where I'm gonna reveal my cards here a little bit. I think out of the context of this show, I really love this song a lot. I think musically it's really interesting, and I think the message is fantastic. But when it's in this show, it's like, I don't know if I believe you singing like these actual lyrics, like you've come to this realization, because you've kind of flip-flopped on this message in particular, like two or three times throughout this show.
Yeah.
And I've never thought the three or four times that I've kind of watched the show, that that central love story is actually all that interesting. It's almost like my least thing in the show that I care about. It's like all the other stuff that's going on. I care more about Faye's journey than his journey.
I care more about Cora and Shub than I care about these two.
Who will speak for Shub? That's what we want to know. There's been something that many of my guests have actually discussed here this season, which is that Sondheim, in this show at least, is using repetition a lot. And in this case, literally the exact same lyric, if there's anything at all. One is like finishing a thought, and then right away it's actually starting a new thought here again. And I can't think of another show where he does this quite so often as he does it in Anyone Can Whistle, where he uses literally the exact same lyrics multiple times, but kind of for like counter purposes. I just wanted to call that out more than anything because I think it's interesting.
I think it's interesting too. And I think that it might be on purpose to kind of reflect this sort of idea of, you know, when you're turning something over and over in your head because you're disturbed by it, right? Sure. And you kind of you're spiraling and you're going over and over the same thing. It's like, I feel like some of that reflects what he may be projecting on the cookies, that's part of what's making them crazy, right? Is that like this sort of repetitive thinking?
I've you're talking to like the master of anxious thoughts here, right? It's like, yeah. so I very much understand what you mean by that. So Hapgood continues on and he says, thanks for everything we did. Everything that's past, everything that's over too fast. None of it is wasted. All of it will last. Everything that's here and now and us together.
Thanks for everything we did. Everything that's past. Everything that's over too fast. None of it was wasted. All of it will last. Everything that's here and now, and us together.
So I realize that, yes, this is a love song, and like we're singing lovely thoughts here. But I want to know your thoughts here on those topics specifically. Like, is love kind of just forgiving the past and moving on? Or is this too simplistic of an idea that he's singing about?
Mom has successfully been in a long-term relationship, so I'm going to throw this one to her.
Well, I don't know. Like, I don't think I subscribe to the love song version of love, having experienced actual and, you know, complicated love. I think what strikes me about that stanza is it's like he's trying to reassure her about something that she is not actually that anxious about. Like, her problem is excessive uptightness.
Sure.
Not feeling like there's instability and that there's nothing that you can hold on to. I'm looking for a rock other than the song There Won't Be Trumpets, where she kind of does go back to, I need somebody to rescue me kind of idea. But I didn't feel like that was her problem, so I don't know why he's reassuring her about that.
Yeah, because I feel like it's even kind of in the text itself where she has like all this empathy for people. Like, that's what is driving her a lot of the time, where it's like she's almost feeling too much than it is like not feeling enough for people. So I think you're right that it just what he's trying to convince her of doesn't really track 100% of what's the situation that's going on.
Unless it's what he wants her to tell him.
Right, yeah, he's trying to convince her.
That's a good reading. That could save that.
Oh, God, I'm fixing the love song. No, it's my worst nightmare.
That's right. Steve, we have some notes for you. Just, write that in the margins here for everyone.
Switch podcasts real quickly. I have some notes.
Yeah, exactly. Then it comes, this is, for some reason, this line makes me laugh, this next one, which was, it was marvelous to know you, is how he continues on. And it isn't really through. Crazy business, this life we live in. Don't complain about the time we're given. With so little to be sure of in this world, we had a moment, a marvelous moment.
It was marvelous to know you. And it isn't really through. Crazy crazy business, this life we live in. Can't complain about the time we're given, with so little to be sure of in this world. We had a moment, a marvelous moment.
How do you feel about the word marvelous in these lyrics?
Seems like a little bit of cheap alliteration, for one thing.
I think of, like, Roald Dahl books when I hear words like that. Like, the words that are really exciting to an 8-year-old little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But it would make sense for Hapgood to say, in terms of his worldview in nature, as somebody who sort of bounces around doing what he pleases. I feel like that kind of word would make sense for the character to use.
Yeah.
So it's a bit more forgivable.
I should point out, too, like, in the actual libretto, like, the spoken bit before this song starts, that's the line he actually says as well. So he says that and then launches into this song, and then it becomes a lyric here later on. For me, like, talking about Roald Dahl or how it's, like, cheap alliteration, it just is such a weird thing to say to somebody that what we're supposed to believe is that he loves her, right? It's like, it was marvelous to know you.
Yeah.
It sounds like such a weird phrase. Even in the 1960s, I think that's such a weird thing to say to people. It's like, someone that I really like, it's marvelous to know you. Like, no way is that coming to a second date then at that point.
I don't
know,
it would make you very memorable.
Sure, sure. It's also in the past tense. Like, it was marvelous to know you.
Yeah.
It's not marvelous to know you now or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So it just, it feels weird how that's, I think, placed into the song itself. But then, crazy business, this life we live in, and then don't complain about the time we're given. This is kind of undercurrent of, like, you know, treasure every second that you have with each other. But I guess I'm going to throw it again, and not to be, like, reiterate points that we may have already made. Does this feel like he's talking about their relationship, or is this more of a general comment that he's making?
Well, I kind of like it better if it's a general comment that he's making. That's sort of like, life is fleeting. Let's not, like, overanalyze and try to get stuck on it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because if he is talking about, you know, that sort of the fleetingness of love, then blah.
Yeah. Like, I see this section more, like, you can probably tell with my analysis so far, more as, like, character development for him, which is a little bit too little too late. But at the same time, I'm seeing more how he has problems getting attached to people, and he's trying to cut this short as quickly as he can and get away because he isn't quite ready to handle what she wants to do, and he's not really... He doesn't feel capable of bending to that in a way that will make it work. So he's kind of like, okay, I guess it's time to go. This was nice. Bye.
Right.
And, like, not really adding a conversation there, just kind of trying to get out while he can.
I wonder, too, like, I can't even recall now, even though I have seen it a few times, do they ever really get into what each cookie's, like, quote-unquote problem is? And in particular, do they ever say what Hapgood is, like, in the cookie jar for, or is it just... Accepted that he's...
Well, I think that, like, he's got all these degrees, and he was an advisor to the president, and what kind of pushed him over the edge was he was an idealist. And I think that the idea is that he was in a position where cynicism is kind of inevitable, and he couldn't handle the disconnect between his own idealism and what he was being asked to do, and so then he just said, forget it, I quit.
So that's an interesting thing, because what I wrote down here as in my notes is that I feel if he's the idealist, because Faye, I don't think, well, she definitely has empathy and stuff for people, but I feel that at many points in this show, the actual creators themselves feel pretty cynical about the world.
Yes. Yeah.
And I don't know how we as an audience are necessarily supposed to feel about that. Are we supposed to feel energized or hopeful by the end of this show? Or are we supposed to be like, you're right, the world sucks? Like, I'm actually conflicted by what I think the central message we're supposed to leave the show with. Is cynicism what we should be leaning into or trying to get away from?
Yeah, well, that's another reason why this is, like, the wrong song to end this show on, I think. Because we know from Sweeney Todd that a show that says... people are terrible.
Mm-hmm.
The end can be good, right? We don't need to be uplifted. We don't need for it to be successful. And maybe they kind of pulled their punches here and said, I don't want to go that dark. That's too dark. But they were still dark enough along the way that people were alienated.
society may be bad, Thoughts? And then they walk away without, like, stating their thesis, really.
Okay, yeah, it's my master's thesis.
Yeah.
It's just this show. It's such, like, I'm not to jump ahead too far, but I mean, I'm very much looking forward to the 1-2 punch that is going to be Into the Woods and then Assassins that came right after that, because that's very much two very different worldviews written by the same people.
Very different worldviews, but there's still along that line. I want to tug more on that thread of the cynicism or real excessive realism of the creators, because both of those shows say people are imperfect. Even people you think are heroes do terrible things, like that, and people who do terrible things have some kind of parts of them that the rest of us can kind of, I don't know,
empathize with or recognize in ourselves.
Like it's just kind of part of that deeper through line of his work, that people are very complicated and nobody is all the way good or all the way bad, and some of us are like a little bit more one way or the other. But
I'm so curious, because I know that Sondheim usually really hates it when people psychoanalyze his life and then into his work. But I feel that there must be something that he is searching for in that, because I don't know how much either of you know about his relationship with his own mom. That's pretty dark.
Very dark.
like his mother did not want to have him and made it very clear that she never wanted to have him.
Yeah.
Sort of thing. So I wonder if that was just him trying to find the goodness in his own life and be like, well, it has to be true. It has to be. Even the worst people out there have to have the shred of humanity inside of them, or else it just would not compute that that his own life would have went the way that it did, sort of thing.
Yeah, I don't know. But he's such a nice person.
Right.
Well, when we see him publicly, he seems like such a nice person. Maybe
he kicks puppies in private.
Yeah. Like, he managed to survive a difficult childhood and turn into a good man, mm-hmm. I feel like. But maybe he's always exploring, like, how do you actually do that in his show?
I also wonder, too, I mean, this is, you know, the love song and stuff. And I think that he dealt with love really interestingly in successive shows in particular. But he's very open about the fact that he didn't really fall in love until he was in his 60s, right? And so I'm wondering, this is like him late 20s, early 30s, I think he would have been in this show. Just like, I think this is what love sounds like. And trying to write that and make it sound good. That's me again, psychoanalyzing a little bit. But I wonder if that's maybe part of it here too. Is like, this is what love language sounds like, because this is what I've heard it sound like for a long, long time.
Yeah, and musicals, like Elizabeth said, they have a lot of love songs. So he's been exposed to a lot of the sort of musical version of love, and maybe he's still channeling that before he gets to, say, Company, mm-hmm. where he's still doing like research on what is love really like, what's marriage really like, and he's kind of asking his friends about that, but ends up with a much more nuanced view of what relationships are.
I agree. So Faye joins the song here at this point and kind of just reiterates a lot of the stuff that's been said here already. So Faye goes, "A marvelous moment, a beautiful time. I need you more than I can say. I need you more than just today. I guess I need you more than you need me, and yet I'm happy. All I'll ever be, I owe you. If there's anything to be, being sure enough of you made me sure enough of me.
A marvelous moment. A beautiful time. I need you more than I can say. I need you more than just today. I guess I need you more than you. Makes me sure enough.
I want to unpack that a little bit. Because, yes, when we first meet Faye, like one of our first songs, even though it's technically a cut song, she's talking about, like, she's waiting for this, like, white knight, this person to come and save her. But I find, like, the rest of the show is shown that's, like, actually she can enact change. She didn't actually need any of those people to come in. She thought she did, but it turns out that, no, she was enough. And yet, here she's saying it was because of him that she found, like, the strength in herself to actually go on. Again, I don't know if you agree with that.
Well, I hate that part because, like, what I like is the Faye that I like the most. Well, her Lady of Lourdes is pretty funny, and I like Come Play With Me. But the Faye I like most is in that monologue before There Won't Be Trumpets, I think, where she's like, I have a loud mouth. And
I talk long and loud.
That's the Faye I like. But that's not the Faye in this song. She's like, I needed you and you made me who I am. And it's like, she was already somebody before he came along. Like, he didn't do anything.
right. Stupid Hapgood.
Yeah.
The podcast where we insult Hapgood for 50 minutes.
That's right. Look for my spinoff podcast coming soon. What I will call out, though, is the couplet that goes, I guess I need you more than you need me, and yet I'm happy. Which, I don't know. Like, I feel like that's actually the reverse is true. That he needs her more than she needs him.
Yeah.
And yet that lyric is given to her to sing first, here at least. It feels odd to me.
It does feel odd. Just from what we know about how this show came together and how it wasn't going well in previews and they were rewriting and they were cutting songs and they were adding songs and everything. I don't know at what point he wrote this song, but if it was towards the end, I almost feel like it's like this isn't going to work and we're just going to get it like end it. Yeah. And people want a happy ending, and so gotta have a love song. Every Shakespeare comedy ends in a marriage and that's right. This is.
Yeah, like he's checking the boxes at the end, and like I think that saying I needed you more than you needed me, that comes again to the fact that he's the one who's trying to leave in this song. He's the pulling away and she's the pulling towards. When we were at theater camp, we did this thing where we had a piece of fabric between two characters and we did a scene while pushing and pulling on that fabric to reflect the tension. It's called Fibimprov, which is a fun name. and I can like kind of see where the tension is going at the beginning of this song. And I think that's very interesting, but also not really played into or allowed to really exist because the relationship is so fleeting and underdeveloped that we don't have that kind of backing information going into it. So it's like there's interesting stuff there in terms of a love song. It's just like it turns into just a love song the way it ends up being done.
Right. The next portion here, depending on the recording, it actually is sometimes I find sung almost like as a call and response, but then the concert version I find they're almost singing simultaneously at the exact same time. But what Hapgood is saying is, the more I memorize your face, the more I never want to leave. Come with me, Faye. There's more of love in me right now than all the little bits of love I've ever known before. While Faye is saying, thanks for everything we did, everything that's past, everything that's over too fast. And then they both come together and say, none of it was wasted, all of it will last, everything that's here and now and us together.
Come with me, Faye.
Thanks for everything we did.
There's more of love in me everything right that's now past. Than all the little bits
everything
of
that's
love
too fast. None of it was wasted.
None of it was wasted.
All of it will last.
All of it will last.
Everything that's here and now and us together.
Yeah, so I think this is Sondheim again experimenting with this like simultaneous singing portions, which he would become much more famous for too, going on and going forward. If it was up to you to fix this love story in this show, what would you do?
Gonna put all the pressure on Mom real quick.
Well, if we have to have a love story, because I'm not convinced that we do, right? But if we're thinking, say, that, like, this, it's interesting to me to compare and contrast this kind of triad here of Faye, Cora, and Hapgood as the mm-hmm. three main characters to Mama Rose, Gypsy, mm-hmm. and Herbie, right? And kind of why that works is Herbie's there for a while and then he's not.
Sure, yeah.
Which, like, the love story ends before the end of the show. And, like, I wonder if Hapgood could be a catalyst for Faye to really not hide behind her fake persona to fight this, but to be Faye that fights this bad thing that's going to happen and then disappear. Like, be as fleeting as this song seems to be talking about this, where they are... they had a moment and it was very, helped her get over some stuff and it was lovely and now it's over. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's what I would like.
So we're just going to take all the Into the Woods energy of those lines and then turn the whole plot into that moment from Into the Woods. I'm on board with that. Absolutely. I feel like that's such a strong song in that show and a strong example of this relationship was not capable of lasting beyond where we are right now.
You're talking about, like, moments in the woods, that song specifically?
That song from I didn't even realize that, but you're exactly right. That's what I'm talking about. The baker's wife and the prince, that's what I want.
He did this right later on, and we're kind of looking at the rough draft of the idea right now.
She should be, was that me? Was that him?
Yeah.
And then that's it. We just end it. And then she walks off stage.
I must leave you.
Why?
The giant.
Will we find each other in the woods again?
This was just a moment in the woods, our moment, shimmering and lovely and sad. Leave the moment, just be glad for the moment that we had. Every moment is a moment when you're in the woods. Goodbye.
What was that?
And then splat.
Splat. Well, yeah.
Maybe we don't have to kill Faye in this one, but yeah.
No. Just a giant's foot comes down on Hapgood, and it's like, that's the end of the show, everyone.
Monty Python theme plays off.
Exactly. So how it ends here then is them both singing together that same lyric. It was marvelous to know you, and it's never really through. Crazy business this life we live in. Can't complain about the time we're given with so little to be sure of in this world. And then Faye kind of fades out saying, hold me. And that's literally how the song ends.
Yeah.
So, like, there's a big swelling of the orchestra after she does that, but literally her last words are asking Hapgood to hold her.
It was marvelous to know you, and it's never really through. Crazy business life we live in. Can't complain about the time we're given. With some little to be sure of in this world.
Disapprove.
Look at all the character development you helped me have. Now support me.
Yeah.
I don't, like, there's no consistency to Faye changing as a character. Like, she changes. She just doesn't change in any, like, reasonable arc. Mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm. back and forth ping pong with how Faye exists in the story.
Yeah, which is too bad because I think, like, definitely Cora has been said, like, she's supposed to be this kind of cartoony villain. Like, that is what her role is supposed to be in this show. Yet Faye is this kind of really interesting character that I really wish they could have really focused on a whole lot more and made her a little bit more internally consistent throughout it. Because that's what I found most about the Faye songs. Even though those are the songs I tend to like the most in the show, it's like, you're... very wildly going back and forth with what it seems to be like your worldview and stuff is. Mm-hmm. And so it's like this weird, like, scattershot feeling if you just listen to the songs straight through.
Yeah. And I do wonder whether we're somewhat hampered by the fact that we haven't seen a real full production, right? So an actress in a proper set without the distraction of the orchestra behind and all the things that a concert version has might have been able to add some depth to added some depth to their characters by the way they interact with each other or the set or stuff like that. And we were seeing, you know, concert versions where the cast was still not even off book, and there's like lots of, it's a concert. It's not a musical play.
It's not a full production. Yeah. When you're doing choreography but with binders in your hand, it's a little bit weird and off-putting.
But at the same time, it clearly didn't work with that original run. Like, that didn't do well. So it can't have been that much better no matter how well the actress was doing, because the book and the lyrics weren't behind whatever interpretation there could have been, really.
Mm-hmm. But I wonder if what we don't like about the show today is different from what the audiences of 1966 didn't like about the show. I mean, Sondheim's theory is that they didn't like about the show was that it was too cynical, too blaming
the audience
for being complicit in whatever bad things were happening, where I like that part.
You're right, I am awful. it's true, though. I think that it's one of those interesting things. I've been having these conversations with people here recently of people revisiting older movies. For some reason, it's happened a bunch of times here this last week, which is like, this movie does not hold up, or this movie is like, it's very weird to watch it now in 2019, where 15, 20, 30 years ago, it was like no one even batted an eye at like the politics or the gender roles and stuff that were in it. And now we're just come to a place like, whoa, that seems a little bit odd and weird that's going on there. And so I think as much as we've evolved with some things, like there's still this really interesting satirical point I think they're trying to aim for, and we're coming at it from this modern lens and being like, but also all this other stuff is like not jiving with what I think we as a society are kind of up to nowadays. So I can go back and forth with whether or not I still think you could make a version of this that would really work for today. It's just that it would take a lot of like pruning and cutting and like rearranging what some of the stuff that's going on here in the show is.
Yeah, I think so. As a song, like you said, you like this song.
I do like the song quite a bit. I've mentioned this a couple times here now. When I first got into this show, this is like very early iTunes for me. When I saw I just typed in Stephen Sondheim and saw what came up, I'm like, anyone can whistle. I've never even heard of this show. I was like, I don't want to commit. If I haven't heard of this show, this probably means it's bad. So I didn't buy the full album. All I did was buy two songs for like the 99 cents each. And so it was Anyone Can Whistle the Song, and then this song, the very final song, which again is like such a weird, like if you just listen to those two songs, you have a very different perspective of what this show is about. And it's like, even from then, it's like, I like this song quite a bit, a divorce from me knowing anything about the show. And I've heard other renditions that are really beautiful. They're great. It's Raul Esparza, right? In the other concert version?
I don't remember. I only remember Scott Bakula now. I can't remember who was in the other one.
But yeah,
you mentioned it was him, I believe.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So in like the, whatever that is, the 2010 whatever concert thing, it's Raul Esparza, Sutton Foster, who's in it. I think that's a lovely performance. Like, it's sung great.
Yeah.
Whether or not it actually works in the show itself is a different matter.
Yeah. I think as soaring love ballads go, if you like that sort of thing, and we kind of don't, but as soaring love ballads go, it's lovely. And I like that sort of people falling in love in song, right? Mm-hmm. Like the call and response or the overlapping stanzas is something that Sondheim would keep working and perfecting, and I like that. And I don't like the sentiments hold me, but it's kind of like an interesting way in isolation to end a song.
It's definitely bold way to end your show, for sure. Elizabeth, I know that you've said that you don't love songs, but are there any examples you can think of that you do? Like, is there a particular type of love song that you like, or is it like just a blanket statement? Like, no, I don't want these in my Broadway, not in my Broadway.
It's very difficult to make me like a love song. I always prefer songs where it's like, we're in love, but also we have bigger things to worry about than the fact that we're currently in love. Like, I really like the song from Sweeney Todd, where it's Joanna and Anthony coming together, like, we have to get you out right away. He means to marry me Monday, all this stuff. Like, she's freaking out. He's trying to calm her down. And at the same time, they're like, oh, we're doing this, right?
If he should marry me Monday, what shall I do on thy
own? We fly tonight.
Tis Friday, virtually Sunday. What can we do with time
so? We fly tonight.
Behind the curtain, quite tonight. I think I heard a click.
Tonight.
It was the gate, it's the gate.
There's no gate.
Kiss
me.
Tonight.
Kiss me.
You mean tonight.
The plan is made, so kiss me.
I feel afraid.
Be not afraid tonight,
my steed.
I like that so much more than just, oh yes, miss, you are attractive. We will become couple now. Like, I like it when you're falling deeper in love, but you're also trying to accomplish something else.
Mm.
In Heather's, there's a song called Our Love is God, where instead of, like, I'm falling in love with Heather's the musical, by the way, which I actually, there are some structural similarities between that show and Anyone Can Whistle that I find interesting. But there's this song where Veronica is falling in love with this homicidal maniac named JD, but she's also realizing that she's being pulled into, like, committing multiple murders with him at the same time. And by the end, she's like, it's like Hold Me. She's just, like, repeating what he's saying and, like, getting frantic. And, like, she realizes this is extremely not good what is happening, but also, like, it's currently happening. And what do I do? And also, like, we are very in love right now, and I'm having a panic attack at the same time. Like, I like songs like that where there's something else going on underneath. We are falling in love, I guess.
I worship you. I'd trade my life for yours.
We'll make them disappear. We'll plant our garden here.
Our love is God. Our love is God. Our love is God. Our love is God. Our love is God.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I think it's like that mentality. The example I give a lot of times for people who tell me that they don't like musicals, which is like, it's like, I kind of get it. If what your perception is like the plot stops and then someone comes to the front of the stage and sings a song and then kind of goes back into the plot. I find that if it's one of those types of songs where it's like, okay, we're stopping, they're going to sing about how they love each other for like a few minutes and not advance what is going on in the story, that can feel like, yeah, we get it. you could have done this in a single line and we could have kind of kept moving on. It can feel a little bit more like, well, this has to happen. So we're going to write the love song and put it in here in the first act and hopefully it carries through for the rest of the show.
Yeah. Which is kind of what this show feels like. It has a little bit more of that, like in strong Sondheim shows, the music pushes the plot along, right? Mm-hmm. And not every song in this show does that.
Yeah, there are a lot of songs where like Lean on Me, where they discuss, like, this is what we are going to do. We have a new plan. This is the plan. Now we will sing about the plan we just made, which is exactly the same thing as we just talked about.
Yeah,
once the song is over, we will repeat everything we just talked about, and then we will do it.
And that's true, yeah.
You can cut both of those sections and just do the song so that the plot's actually moving forward when the song is happening.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But instead, the book, like, overcompensates and then, like, it's all dialogue and the song no longer feels like it needs to exist.
This is why I put more credence. This is another thing that Sondheim writes in his book about how he truly believes there needs to be the three different creative forces behind the show, the director, the book writer, and then the songwriter, whoever's doing the music. At least for a musical, that would be true. Because here, it was Arthur Lawrence who wrote the book and was directing the show. And he says, like, there just was not that third person to be like, don't do that. Yeah. Like, you're just in it too much with your, like, you're in love too much with your own stuff. Cut this, and focus on this. So I actually lead a lot of, I think I agree with that more than I disagree with it.
Mm-hmm. Although then he says, except if you're Jerome Robbins, I think.
No, I think the only person he says is, oh my gosh, the guy who directed Into the Woods.
Oh, James Lapine. Lapine, yeah.
It says, like, he's the only person I've seen who can direct both, and write the show. Because he's able to, like, prune it. If it doesn't work, just cut it. So Sondheim does know that this song is weird to end off. So I don't know. Did either of you have a chance to read what he writes at the end of this chapter at all?
I don't think so.
So he writes this really interesting story. So he's like, he knew he had to fix this. He super knew he had to fix this. And so what he did one last time, there's another tryout. And he goes and he says what he likes to do when he's when they're in the rehearsal period or in the tryout period, is he'll go to the theater and sit in the very last row. So he can, like, run out as soon as he needs to. So basically what he does, he watch the show, like, last orchestrations or, like, the sweep and love song, and he bolts. So he just runs out of the theater and runs down the stairs into the men's washroom that was there in the theater and literally, like, clapped his hands over his ear so he could, like, hear the notes that were still in his head. He's like, is there something I can do? Is there something that can happen? Which is when he heard the door behind him open, and apparently, like, this middle-aged theater goer came in and looked at him and says, like, hope you don't have money in the show. Continue to go and, like, do his business in the washroom. And it's like, that basically sums up how this show went. There really wasn't a way to fix it effectively. Yeah. He was hoping that there was. But basically what he ends off here with is saying, so he's still thankful for the experience, because it says, it gave me my first chance to write extended song forms involving dialogue, as in simple, and allowed me to use pastiche for comment on character and style, as in chorus songs and the cookie chase, devices I continued to experiment with in subsequent shows. It was a laudable attempt to present something off-center in mainstream musical theater. It was my first direct inheritance from Allegro, which was a Oscar and Hammerstein show. But he says, and like Allegro, it didn't work. So, like, overall, I think him and Arthur Lawrence especially, like, they still have, like, this great fondness for this show. Like, they still like it in theory, even though they realize, like, it just doesn't function as a great piece of theater. There's elements that are there. It just does not ever come together as a whole, unfortunately.
Yeah. And I think as Sondheim fans, we can be grateful for this show because you learn so much more from mistakes than success, right?
Yeah, a lot, yeah.
And he learned what a lot of things that work and a lot of things that didn't, that we might not have got some of the better shows later on, or what we think of better shows later on, if he hadn't had this experience in the next one.
Well, yeah, I think in particular, this is almost going to, like, ruin the thesis for the next, like, season that we talk about, which is Do I Hear a Waltz? But he mentions that. It's like, I would much rather have a failure that I believe in than a failure I don't, which is what the next show is. Like,
right.
No one believed in that show. And it's like, he shouldn't have done it. Like, he just should not have done that show. But from those two experiences, then you go on with this amazing run then of a bunch of great shows that happen, bang, bang, bang. And then we get to Merrily We Roll along years later. And that's a whole other kettle of fish that's interesting to talk about. I guess overall, I know we talked a little bit about the show, about this song. Any final thoughts either of you have about Anyone Can Whistle?
I'm really surprised how many of these songs are sticking in my head.
Mm.
I think I will listen to this soundtrack again for fun. Just, you know, we were studying up to be on your show, so it wouldn't sound dumb. But I like a lot about this show, even though I've been spending a lot of time talking about how I don't like it, and it's the music itself that is attractive to me.
Yeah.
There are a lot of writers who, like, put a bunch of time and energy into a project and then realize this has a lot of good ideas, but I failed to make this project good.
Mm-hmm.
And then a lot of people will put that in, like, another folder for a while and cannibalize it into other things. That's kind of what I feel happened with this show, except he also published it and then he realized, oh, this was supposed to go in the cannibalization folder afterwards. And he, like, managed to do that and, like, bring in a lot of those ideas and, like, motifs and everything into other shows very, very effectively, but it just wasn't quite there yet with this one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a good way to phrase it. Like, you see that with like novelists and even film directors and stuff sometimes, where they have one, it's like, oh, that didn't work, and then you can kind of see those same themes pop up again and again until they kind of, like, come fully formed in something that is actually great. So yeah, that's, I think, where I'm coming down with here at the very end of, like, really thinking back on this show of being like, I'm glad for what it gave to him, even though I don't like the show, like, in total, sort of thing.
It was a marvelous moment.
It was a marvelous moment, yeah. Now, I just realized I forgot to do something. I was going to play this game, which I did not prepare for, so give me, like, five seconds. So, this is going to be a very short game.
Yes.
Because none of the concert versions or anything were nominated for Tonys in the year. They were not even special awards or anything like that. So we're only going to talk about the original production back in 1964. So how many Tonys do you think this show was nominated for?
Mom knows how the Tonys work, and I don't, so I'm going to throw this one
over
to her.
Sure, sure.
It's just an award show where, I think maybe it only got, I'm going to say one.
You would be correct. You win the game. It was nominated for one award. Do you want to guess which award it was nominated for?
I also don't know what the names of the awards are. I'm going to guess like something like choreography.
Oh, ding, ding, ding. Oh, you got it.
Well, because you loved the choreography even in the concerts. Yeah.
Was that the 2010 version?
Yeah.
Even in the very, very negative New York Times review, this is the one thing that they were actually positive on was the choreography of the show. And so it was nominated. Do you think it won?
No, I bet Tony voters are kind of soak up the stink when a show fails. So I'm going to say no.
Correct. Yes, it did not win. This was a really interesting year, 1964, because there was two big shows that also debuted in 1964, which was Funny Girl with Barbara Streisand and Hello Dolly with Carol Channing. Hello Dolly basically like ran away with it. It basically won everything that year. So the lovely named Gower Champion was the choreographer of Hello Dolly, and he is the one who won in 1964.
Do you like that show?
Hello Dolly?
Yeah.
I do like Hello Dolly, yes.
Okay, I've seen it once, and I hated it. I hated it so much. I hated the song. I hated the what seemed to me like jingoism. I hated the
music. It's probably another one that probably does not hold up very well when you like look at it in modern day, for sure. But it's interesting. I do overall like Jerry Herman. Even though we'll eventually get to a very particular Tony Awards where he's pretty dismissive of Sondheim on stage. although apparently they were friendly enough with each other. They at least called each other contemporaries. But we'll eventually get to there. But in many ways, I shouldn't say he's the anti-Sondheim Jerry Herman, because he's not really. It's just that he goes for hummable songs, like 100%. Like that is his thing. He wants you leaving there, tapping your feet, and being able to sing that song at the end of it. And sometimes I just don't think was ever worried about that ever in his entire career.
No, he managed to accomplish that by accident. But I think you're right; he wasn't doing that on purpose, and he certainly didn't want every song to be like that, because it wouldn't do what it's supposed to do.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, the both of you, for joining me here today. If people wanted to, what is the best way that they can follow you online?
Well, our podcast is on Twitter at That's a Thing YEG. That's a Thing YEG. YEG is Edmonton, where we live.
It's a Canadian thing. We like to go by airport codes in our cities.
I realize we're talking to an international audience here, and that will make no sense whatsoever. But anyway, That's a Thing YEG on Twitter. I am Karen Unland on all of the social media. And Elizabeth, do you want them to know you?
Yeah, sure. I'm on Twitter and Instagram at ElizaDeath, YEG. My Twitter used to be different, but I changed it to a pun to show how much I've grown as a person.
I appreciate that. Yeah. All right, perfect. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Kyle. This is super fun.
Thank you for having us.
That was fun.
Yes.
Good times.
If only I could remember. I've done so much math since then.
All right, before we go, we'll let you know that this episode of That's a Thing is also brought to you by TELUS World of Science Edmonton, home of the Canadian debut of Marvel Universe of Superheroes. That exhibition is running until February 17th. Edmonton is the only Canadian city to be hosting it, or at least the first one. It features more than 300 artifacts, costumes, props, and interactive elements to bring the Marvel Universe to life. You saw
the Marvel Universe come to life with your own eyes, didn't you?
Yes, I went last week. My friend Krista had a gift card, and so she took me. It was a very nice break from the math, so I appreciated it. It's beautifully laid out. It's very aesthetically pleasing, easy to follow, and also just a lot of really interesting information, especially on the history of Marvel and the people behind it, as well as how it kind of evolved with the times and how its characterization progressed. It's very interesting.
Very cool.
There's also a section on Canadian superheroes, which I'm a little bit geeky about, so especially pay attention to that part.
You can experience all that and more yourself if you buy tickets at tellusworldofscienceedmonton.ca. That's tellusworldofscienceedmonton.ca. And before we head into our credits, I just want to mention that in our last episode, we briefly discussed the copyright lawsuit that's causing some disruption at schools across Canada, including your very own school.
At Ross Shepherd, where you can see Legally Blonde put on by the musical company. More details pending. But also where we'll correct our laissez-faire approach to information.
Well, I was just, I was talking to friend of the show, Matt Bowes, who's host of Bollywood is for Lovers, for our final log rolling of the episode here. And as you might expect, the issue is rather more complex than our brief diversion suggested.
Nuance in my podcast, never.
Anyway, the upshot all this is it's the provincial governments that are actually responsible for making teachers dig up 7 years worth of lesson plans, not so much the publishers. Mm-hmm. And the Canadian publishers are trying to get paid for letting you guys use their material. And they just want less than $2.50 per student per year to do that, which is quite a bit less than buying like the whole book for mm-hmm. $50 or whatever it is. Anyway, it's complicated. But we're going to link to a statement from Access Copyright, which represents Canadian publishers, in the show notes. And you'll be able to find that and everything that we've mentioned at thatsthing.transistor.fm.
Rad.
You can subscribe to our show in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, wherever else pods are cast, including the CKUA app. You can also find us and the rest of the members of the Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATB, at albertapodcastnetwork.com. Many thanks to John for editing this part of the episode, and many thanks to Kyle for editing and producing
and hosting
the bulk of this episode. We're on Twitter at That's a Thing YEG. You can always email us a question or a comment at thatsathingyeg@gmail.com. Is that everything?
That is everything. It was mostly you, and I should probably be asking you that question.
That's okay.
Is that everything?
I think so.
Thanks, Mom.
Bye.